From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the Milwaukee County Board Chair says all options should be on the table for funding cultural attractions.
I'm going into this open-minded and looking at it as a way, again, to reduce property taxes by shifting the funding in perhaps the sales tax or other options.
A new documentary tells the story of Marquette's iconic 1977 basketball uniforms. We'll meet the well-known director and the basketball player who designed the jerseys. And Kent Knapp is a Milwaukee blacksmith, very much by choice.
I love this craft. I'm crazy head over heels with it. I just think it's the coolest thing. I spend my hours studying it, and you combine that with my love for Milwaukee.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening this morning. The task force considering the future of Milwaukee's downtown arena issue and funding for other cultural institutions got a close look at the latest study offering some possibilities. The Public Policy Forum unveiled its report called The Show Must Go On last week and presented it to the task force yesterday. It features a study of how five other communities took on the challenge and examines how four models could be applied in the Milwaukee area. One major issue being addressed is the future of the cultural attractions on Milwaukee County's rolls, such as the Milwaukee County Zoo. Marina Dmitrievich is chairwoman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors and serves on the Cultural Task Force. She's with us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So the Cultural Task Force has just been briefed by the Public Policy Forum on its reporting on establishing a dedicated funding stream for cultural institutions. You've had a chance to kind of go over it more in depth in the last few days. If you would just share your impressions with the kinds of suggestions and possibilities that that report floats in its many pages, that'd be great.
Sure. You know, the first report we had showed us the depth of need throughout our community for our cultural assets and entertainment, you know, zone that we have here in attractions. The second part by the Public Policy Forum gets into a deeper look of what it would take and how much it would cost and other models in other cities to move forward. And then lastly, it's how do we group together what it is that we want to do and make the right decision in the most transparent process. So the reaction that I had was that we have the ability here to significantly invest in our infrastructure and our cultural assets. And the question is how. What is the right mix? What is the public okay with? But we can do that, and we can also take many of these assets and amenities off of our property taxes. So the question is what do we want our Milwaukee County to look like in the future?
Well, right. There are some who think this process ought to be used to look at the future of specifically county-funded cultural attractions like the zoo and the public museum and decide whether some fundamental shift in how we fund those institutions ought to take place. What's your take on whether that ought to be a big part of this equation?
Well, I'm glad you outlined those two. The zoo and the Performing Arts Center actually that are county-owned and supported for many years via our property tax dollars actually see many of their patrons, the majority of their customers from outside of Milwaukee County. That's why I was so disappointed that some of our surrounding partners, and I call them partners because they are, in the region have decided already to start the conversation with a no. No, we're not going to do this specific tax. I'm going into this open-minded and looking at it as a way, again, to reduce property taxes by shifting the funding in perhaps the sales tax or other options. Remember, the voters in 2008 in Milwaukee County supported that shift from a property tax to a sales tax. And it's definitely time to move Milwaukee forward when it comes to these cultural amenities.
Well, can the process move forward if surrounding counties don't get on board? Is there a way to move forward if this is just Milwaukee County and Milwaukee City?
We're going to have to. I really don't see another option. We've come far enough. And I want to also mention many of us choose to live and own homes here in Milwaukee County because of this wonderful park system and cultural assets that we have in entertainment. And quite frankly, the suburbs are what they are because of their close proximity to Milwaukee, whether they want to say it or not. So I do see it moving forward, and there's going to be some tough decisions that have to be made, which is why I'm trying to go out in the community and talk to as many people as possible and find out what the right balance and mix taxes. But again, I see movement. The voters have already voted on a sales tax previously in 2008, and we have to put together a package that everyone can stand by in the most transparent, accountable way.
One of the issues that the Public Policy Forum raised was the idea that there needs to be a philosophical question answered right off the bat, that it involves just what sorts of entities we look at in terms of establishing a funding stream. I realize this is maybe a ways down the road in the decision-making process, but what's your take on just how broad-based an approach we ought to be taking?
Great question. I'm coming in with a different mindset. I'm trying to look at what things can we say yes to? What can we invest in? And so I definitely, working in Milwaukee County here and serving Milwaukee County for 10 years this April, I know how valuable our county assets are, and again, how that results in also a property tax reduction. So that's one thing I'm very interested in. I definitely see the benefit of tourism dollars in an entertainment zone, and I want to keep the Milwaukee Bucks here. I think that's important. And then lastly, I also think that we need to seriously consider funding Milwaukee County transportation. All of those connect to moving our county forward, and those are the three items that are the most important to me to try to get them in the mix.
And we want to talk about transit here in just a moment. But before we get there, make the case for me. You know, you and I have talked about any number of serious issues that the city faces, the county faces, the state faces. Why arts and culture and entertainment? Why should we spend so much time being concerned about them?
That's a profound question. And I think this discussion began with, well, okay, we're talking about culture and assets, but what are we not talking about? Education or crime or public safety or mental health? Look, we need to move forward, and it's a holistic approach, comprehensive. All of these are parts of a county growing and moving forward. And I really think there is a true economic impact living in a county that has these arts and cultural assets available. They're directly related to job creation. I think they're embedded in education. And what's most important to me is that if there is public money going into these assets, which they already are in many of the county-owned ones, that it be available and financially accessible to everyone in Milwaukee County. Because that is a way that we can, again, grow our county and put ourselves on the map even more. We want to be a destination because I believe that we already are.
I know the Public Policy Forum looked specifically at five different areas around the country as potential models for how it could be done. Mm-hmm. Were there any that struck you as especially intriguing?
A couple. So first of all, like I've said, the sales tax, when you look at the power of it, the 0.7% would bring up $700 million. I mean, imagine what you can do. That's what was really the impact of this report, is the power of the investment here. We could, again, continue to grow ourselves into this world-class city and county and region, really, I hope. And again, we know that when Milwaukee County and our region succeeds, the state of Wisconsin succeeds. So that was something that stood out, especially because the voters of Milwaukee County already spoke on that issue. Lastly, I remain intrigued with the extension of the Miller Park tax because it's a tax that's already there and that has been approved, and we're already paying for it. Now, I know there's questions about the timing and would it add up, but I don't think that should be taken off the table. I really don't think anything should be taken off the table. The cigarette tax as well, again, that was looked at, you know, a few years ago, that was increased, but I think it's about finding the right mix, and there's a lot of potential there as well as property tax reduction.
What do you see as the way forward in terms of even framing how the decision-making process will take place?
Now, that is probably one of the most important things here. So I do sit on this task force, and I'm really happy to do that. And I'm going above and beyond and having these coffee and culture sessions throughout the county. I have one March 28th at 10 a.m. at the Charles Alice Museum on the east side here. But I think it's important that we include as many people as possible. After all, this is a public resource. So what's important to me is that once we move forward and we decide on the funding mechanism, the voters have weighed in, that it is a public elected board or entity, not just an appointed private entity, that is overseeing the funding of these assets, because it's a lot of public money involved here. We want complete transparency and accountability all the way through.
Well, and it should be noted that this is a task force that includes many different kinds of stakeholders, but it doesn't necessarily have any teeth. It doesn't have the power to say, this is how we're going to decide this.
No, it doesn't. It's a great sounding board and forum. I mean, you're right. There's a mixture of elected officials and business leaders and educational members as well. It's a great snapshot of the community. But in the end, the decision makers, like I said, need to be an open, accessible, I believe, elected board that would finalize how we go forward. And ultimately, it sounds to me that the decision would be to the voters. Every one of those options leads to the state having to authorize a binding referendum. So it will come down to the people.
Well, let's talk about the future of transit for a moment here. There had been a contract awarded to company MV Transportation to operate the transit system in the future. There were appeals filed, and since then we've gone back to square one. Why did the county board's review take us back to the beginning of the process again?
Just like you mentioned, there was a competitive process, and then there were two vendors who were not chosen who decided to file an appeal because they thought there were problems in the process. A county board panel that was deciding on the appeals held a lengthy debate and decided that there were many flaws in the process that led to that award. So we are at square one, and we're asking the administration to send out a new request for proposals, reopen the bids, learn from the mistakes that were made, and try to move forward as soon as possible so that we can have another competitive process. And again, look at another vendor at the same time while we're evaluating bringing Milwaukee County Transit in-house to a county-run model. I think both of those pieces of information should be before us before we move forward.
Can you go into greater depth about what the flaws that the county board found in the process were and what lessons you take from it?
Sure. We definitely need to, first of all, improve the transparency. The decision makers were not even given the information surrounding the award of the bid or the contract, I should say, until very late in the process. So that was difficult to move forward. Some of the other flaws that were found were just the process itself, the communication, the fact that at one point one of the vendors was able to go back and adjust their response. And then lastly, the due diligence on the pricing points. There were some questions surrounding whether the pricing model was actually going to be realistic. And so a couple of those issues came up. And, you know, it's okay that there were mistakes made. This is a very huge contract and one of the first times that it's been as competitive in our history. So let's just take note and make the changes and move forward. And that's what we're asking.
Well, you were just a moment ago talking about the desire to look at possibly moving to a county-run model. Mm-hmm. Given all the financial pressures that the county is already facing, why would the county want to get back in the business of not just overseeing the transit system, but operating the transit system?
Sure. Already, it's a very huge county asset in that we own the buses, we put a lot of county money into it, and we're responsible for the assets that are there, and the funding all comes through the county. So really what we do is we contract with a couple of people that make up the current vendor to manage it. And the question is that, you know, we've had some challenges in the past, and if we bring that in-house, we'd have even more accountability and transparency for all the public money that has gone in. And I'm not saying that I totally support that because I need the information first. But the question is to compare that evaluation with a new process that's more transparent for the private bids, and then look at the best decision to grow our transit system. Because in the end, I want the most modern and efficient system for Milwaukee County's economic infrastructure.
The company that had been awarded the bid, this is MV Transportation, basically said it could do more with less. You know, that's the real issue that that transit has been facing here, is that the pool of money is shrinking and the needs aren't shrinking at the same time. Is it your belief that more could still be done with less?
I'm interested in exploring that. I mean, that was what was really attractive about some of the responses to the request for proposal. I mean, we saw some very exciting things. And honestly, the other vendors, the larger groups, have a larger possibility of bulk purchasing because some of these other companies have huge international contracts and business models. They're able to save money that way. That's a fact. And you can't really debate that. And then those savings can be poured back into the system to produce more routes at a lower fare. That's what I'm interested in, is more service for a lower fare and the best and top technology out there, because we do need to grow. I do believe we're slightly behind when it comes to modernization.
So you have these listening sessions fairly frequently as part of what you do. I mean, you must hear the complaint from constituents a fair amount. People say, you know, why can't the county just figure out a solution for transit and stick with it?
Well, I do think there is a yearning for transit to be improved. And if you remember, too, when I first became chair, I actually tried to take the bus to every single municipality in the 19 in Milwaukee County. And what I found was that I could not get there. And that's a problem. But I'll tell you, no vendor, no private operator is going to solve that. That's a larger problem. And it's how we fund transit in the state of Wisconsin. cut after cut. I mean, we're celebrating a small restoration of a 10% cut in this last biennial budget. So it begins there. It's not trickling down. We need help from the state of Wisconsin to invest in what is the economic engine of our state. And I also think that we need to shift it off of the property taxes. We are one of the only systems that still uses the property tax. So until we can have a real investment in transit, it's not just this box of money that anyone is trying to operate, until then we're not going to see it properly grow. And I think, again, we need more routes and cheaper fares. We need to change the culture here in Milwaukee County so that people want to ride the bus and get out of their cars, because it's better for our environment and our economy.
Marina Dmitrievich, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marina Dmitrievich is chairwoman on the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors and a member of the task force considering future funding ideas for a downtown arena and cultural institutions. We'll take a quick break now, and then the story of a revolutionary basketball uniform in its time and place, which happened to be 1977 and Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Marquette University's men's basketball season is over. They lost in the first round of the Big East tournament, which meant no trip to the NCAAs, and then even the second-tier NIT tournament passed over the Golden Eagles. So Marquette fans this spring will have to comfort themselves with past successes, not the least of which was the team's one NCAA championship earned in 1977. It was a huge moment for sports in Milwaukee and a watershed moment for sports uniforms, as the team, then called the Warriors, wore uniforms that looked like nothing else on the court. What's more, the uniforms were designed by a player, Bo Ellis, who was taking design classes at Mount Mary even as he played for Marquette. We'll hear from him in a few minutes, but first, the iconic 1977 uniforms are the subject of a new documentary called Untucked. That's part of ESPN's 30 for 30 series. It's directed by actor Danny Pudi, best known as a star of the NBC sitcom Community and a Marquette grad himself. We met up with him when he returned to his alma mater recently. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me. I feel cozy, and I'm very familiar with Lake Effect snow, being from Chicago, and it's good to be back here and get a taste of it.
Well, and fortunately, the weather so far has been cooperative.
Yeah, I just landed an hour ago, so as soon as I got here, I could see the patterns in my skin forming immediately, seeing the creases, and in between my knuckles, seeing some of the patterns there. I know my skin is just dry enough to remind me that this is winter.
Well, let's talk basketball, and specifically Marquette basketball, and specifically Marquette basketball uniforms. You have done this film as part of ESPN's 30 for 30 series. What set that project in motion for you?
I tell people it was sort of a funny way to start a project, because it was a conversation on Twitter. I had been a fan of their films, and after one of the films called Benji, which was a really great documentary about a basketball player in Chicago and sort of his tragic story, and I tweeted about it, and one of the 30 for 30 producers, Dan Silver, tweeted me back, and we started this conversation, this dialogue, and eventually led to a conversation of would I be interested in participating in their 30 for 30 series in the shorts, which is what they've been doing now more and more once a month online. And I said, yeah. And he asked me if I had any ideas, and I said, yeah. And for me, this is a treat, because this is an idea I've always had. I've always been a huge fan of Marquette sports, and in particular, the basketball program. Growing up, I was always very aware of Al McGuire and the presence of the team. And so this was a chance for me to explore something that I was really passionate about, but I just never really thought that there was going to be a platform for it.
You went to Marquette a generation or maybe two generations removed from the national championship and Al McGuire and this particular iconic uniform, but yet that history is still a huge part of your identity?
Yeah, I mean, in 1997, they actually wore the untucked jersey in a throwback game, and that's the year I graduated from high school, so I was aware of it there, and it was something for me that was so striking because I was always part of the generation growing up. You always had to have your jersey tucked in. You always have to tuck everything in. And in my family in particular, my mom still yells at me if my shirt's untucked. And so that to me was very like, oh, that's cutting edge. I want to explore that a little bit more. So I was aware of that. And then Al McGuire at the time was really popular doing as a sports broadcaster. So there was always a curiosity about who is this guy? What's up with that program? They seem different. They seem cool. And I like that.
Not to attach too much significance to it, but do you think there's something symbolic in the whole idea of things being untucked, like sports was a different animal in those days and maybe less buttoned down than it is today?
For sure. I think that there's something to me tremendously exciting about the Wild West days of anything, you know, whether it's the internet right now, you know, or, you know, basketball and the commercialization of basketball at that time, because jersey sales weren't a thing yet, you know, and even basketball on television was starting to become a thing, and Marquette was capitalizing on that by having a big game every Saturday night. And I think one of the ways that they capitalized on that and really kind of established a national presence was by displaying these jerseys on Saturday night on television. But there was definitely a little bit of a looser sort of feel to how everything worked and operated then. And I think because of that, they were allowed to really explore a lot of creativity, which was cool.
Well, and kind of bizarre that a player had a hand in the design itself.
Yeah, I think now that would never happen. And I think that to me was one of the things where I was like, this is amazing. Literally a basketball player who's coming in as one of the best basketball players in the country also has this equal interest in fashion design. And the coach doesn't only embrace it, but allows him to pursue that at another school, at Mount Mary College, and also then allows him to display his talents in the uniforms that they wear on the court. And that to me just felt so like cutting edge and new and innovative in many ways. I just thought that was such a cool thing to explore, which was really Al McGuire giving Bo a platform to display his talents.
Well, and it's interesting in talking to Bo Ellis about this design to listen to him talk about what inspired it and how the design itself came together. The word marketing never came up.
Yeah, because I don't think that's not what it was about. And I think that's, to me, one of the things that I think is important about this story. And it's important about, you know, sports and creativity is sometimes it's, I think that we're thinking about marketing before we're actually thinking about why we're doing something, you know, and that's become sort of the nature of business in many ways. And there's something fun to me about exploring a story where it was just a guy who had an idea and it was just a coach who was like, let's try it. And I think that was something that's really exciting. And I think a lot of great ideas are born that way. And in some ways, I hope we can always continue to have that in some area where we can always be allowed to sort of explore creativity and just see what it gets us without having to worry about who the target demo is.
Well, and you know, you think about it, and the other thing that makes this story amazing is the fact that there's this confluence with the national championship. I mean, you know, Bo Ellis could have played for the University of Akron and designed their uniform, and they could have finished third in their conference and nobody would be thinking about this. I was trying to think of any other time that an iconic uniform was also associated with the national championship, and I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I couldn't either. I'm sure there's something. Yeah, I'm sure there's one for you fact checkers out there. But that to me was also another thing I really wanted to explore. I think for me, I always like to believe in the power of collaboration, and I also like to believe in the power of a lot of different things contributing to a greater thing happening. And so I don't know if it's what won them the national championship, but I do believe by Bo being allowed to create something off the court, it did help that 1%, which may have tipped everything into Marquette's favor that year. And so I think that it's fun to kind of take one little piece of what a championship run was and see, you know, how much that influenced or maybe inspired the team to also be creative and loose. And I think that's my argument. I believe that to encourage creativity ultimately will lead to good things. Maybe not a national championship always, but in this case, I think it did help just a little bit.
Well, and sportscasters always talk about a great player putting the rest of the team on his back. And in this case, literally
The rest of the team had Bo Ellis on its back.
That's very true. I think this is, yeah, the first time I've actually heard that, but this is very little on their backs and their fronts, and yeah, that's, yeah, all the way down, you know, outside of their shorts.
Yeah. You talk about collaboration, and you worked on this movie with Chris Marrs, who was another actor and comedian who went to Marquette. Did the Marquette alums in Hollywood all kind of know each other?
We do. They're actually all here. I mean, Kevin Farley, Pat Finn, John Farley, and Chris Marrs. And for us, it's a fun thing to get together because although we do live, you know, in Los Angeles, that we do have this spirit of the Midwest. We've all come here and experienced a harsh winter and know what it's like and carry that with us. And it was great working with Chris. We're always trying to collaborate in different ways. And Chris and I have become really good friends and partners in many projects. And he was definitely one of my producers and a big help here because he's also very knowledgeable in sports. And he was making sure I didn't mess up.
You play a college student on Community. Is your time at Marquette in evidence at all in the character that we see?
I think in some ways. I mean, at Marquette, I was known as study poison, so...
That's what I hear.
Yeah, I think you could see some hints of study poison in Abed. So I try to. I try to take bits of my experience here at Cut of Hay or not studying and try to think back on what was I doing. The nice thing about playing a student for 10 years is you get to relive all those glorious moments. But at the same time, then I get to go home to my wife and kids.
We are having this conversation while the Olympics are going on, which are full of, I'll just say it, bizarre uniforms. Do you, after producing a film like this, feel like you're more clued into sports uniforms in general?
Oh, yeah. I mean, throughout this project, it was really interesting for me, too, because the NBA was, you know, releasing these new uniforms with sleeves. And so I'm hyper aware of it now. And I've actually always been sort of interested in uniforms, and I think it's just a really cool way to, you know, I think Deion Sanders said, you look good, you play good, you feel good, you know, it's that kind of thing. But also I think as a fan base, you know, I'm a fan, and it's a great way for me to identify and be like, that's my team, that's my squad. So yeah, I'm definitely into it. I knew right away when the figure skating couple was dressed as the Pink Panther, and I was into it, you know. So I look out for that, and I appreciate when people do take extra bold steps. Sometimes it doesn't work, but I think it's a great way to sort of be like, here's me as an individual also putting a stamp on this.
I have not been fortunate enough to see this film yet, but does ESPN's uniform guy Paul Lucas play any role in this?
He doesn't, but I mean, he did in the initial phases because I followed his blog, and you know, I definitely made sure to look back and see some of his articles and see what uniforms he mentioned, and I know he did mention the untucked jersey being one of those that people definitely talked about 30 years ago. So my props to him because his knowledge is probably way stronger than mine.
Well, Danny Pudi, thanks so much, and welcome back to Milwaukee.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Actor Danny Pudi is director of Untucked, a documentary about Marquette University's revolutionary 1977 basketball uniforms. Pudi is a Marquette graduate and is best known for a role on the sitcom Community. There is a link to watch the movie from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Those iconic basketball uniforms were designed by former Marquette player Bo Ellis. We'll talk with him when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tite. Maurice Bo Ellis is the only basketball player in Marquette University history to play in two NCAA Final Fours, including in the 1977 season when the team won the national championship. But as we heard before the break, he was also the only player to design the team's uniforms as well. And those uniforms were the focus of a documentary called Untucked, produced as part of ESPN's 30 for 30 series. Bo Ellis went on to play for three seasons in the NBA with the Denver Nuggets and was a head coach in college for several seasons as well. Today, he lives in the Milwaukee area once again, and he joined us to share his part of the story. Thanks for taking a few minutes out to talk.
Thank you for having me on.
And designer of an iconic uniform.
Oh, yes, still getting credit for it some 40 years later, but never received one penny as a part of actually getting a patent on it. And I used to argue and laugh with Coach McGuire all the time, you know, years later. During tournament time when people would come to us about the uniforms being designed, and I used to tell Coach, I like, Coach, if you would have told me I could get a patent on this, I would be rich today. But, you know, it is still being talked about, so it's still a great thing. And even though I didn't get paid for it, it still has set a trend in life and college sports. That's more than money could ever buy.
And so let me ask you this. What originally led you to want to study? You were taking a course in fashion design at Mount Mary, and that's how this emerged. Is that right?
Well, I could draw real well. I've always been able to draw real well. And I came from a high school where we liked to dress. And, you know, we would go to the tailor and, you know, get clothes made. And back in the day, we wore walking suits and put initials on it, fancy pockets, dog ear collars. And a lot of people probably don't know what all that is. So I used to draw things up for different people on my team in high school, but I was very gifted not only as a basketball player, but God gave me a gift of being very good with my hands and being able to draw. So that's how this whole fashion thing started. So when I came and was going away to college and I knew I was going to go to Marquette, Coach McGuire asked me what I wanted to major in. And naturally, you know, I was going to Marquette to play basketball. I never checked to see what the curriculums were or anything like that. So when Coach asked me what I wanted to major in, I said fashion designing. And I didn't have any idea that this was a Jesuit. I knew it was a Jesuit Catholic school, but, you know, the curriculum that was there. So that's how it all started and was something that I was able to do before I came to Marquette.
Do you remember when the light bulb went off? I mean, the revolutionary part of the design, and certainly one of the things that inspired the film that harkens back to the shirt. One of the revolutionary parts was that Marquette was written along the bottom hem, and the shirt was meant to be worn untucked. Do you remember when the light bulb went off?
Well, that part of it was a collaboration between the designing people at Medless Industry that Coach McGuire was actually the president for. And I think why is because I never really wore my jersey in. You know, I would tuck it in, jump ball would go up. After 1 minute of play, I would always just pull my jersey out. It was just a lot more comfortable for me. And then, too, the jerseys were so long and the shorts were so short that, you know, when they were tucked in, the jersey was almost coming out of the shorts. They were so short. So I would just pull mine out and make it a little longer. And that's, I think, the people from Metalist saw that and came up with that idea. And they asked me what I think about it. I told them that one may not be a bad idea, but it was Lloyd Walton's actual suggestion to Coach McGuire that he let me design the uniforms for the tournament that year. And that's how the whole thing just started out.
I don't know that I've heard of any other instance in the history of sports where one of the players has had a hand in designing the uniform. Did it seem at all strange that this was a role you were playing in addition to the role that you played on the court?
Well, not really, because like I said, in high school, I used to design different things. I would draw up different suits, pants, walking suits, and different things for people at school because they knew of my ability to draw real well. So I didn't really think much of it. And realistically, not until years later did I realize how significant and how much of a pioneer and a trendsetter I was becoming by doing it until I got older and was out of school.
Does it amaze you at some level that people still remember and talk about this uniform that you designed?
Well, now I'll be 60 years old in August of this year. You know, nothing surprises me now. It's really a part of my life. Most people know how good I was as a player and the greatness of our teams, but a lot of people, when they see me, you know, not only do they talk about, you know, us winning the national championship, but they say, you're the one that designed the uniform. So to that extent, it is very humbling and still amazing that people connects me with the uniforms that we design outside in almost some 45 years later.
Do you remember what the uniforms looked like before you got to them? Did you look at the uniforms as you were getting to Marquette and think to yourself, well, I could do better than that?
No, not at all. I had no idea that, I would want to do that. Clothes was my forte. Uniforms, nothing. You know, that was just something that was introduced to me once I came to Marquette. But I never thought about designing uniforms or even had any thoughts about it. Actually, to Lloyd Walton, went to coach about it, and that's how it all took place.
Do you have a critical eye towards clothes and sports uniforms today, given that experience that you had? Do you look at what people are wearing as they're around you or what you see when you watch a basketball game or any kind of sporting event today?
Oh, absolutely. It amazes me. Now I watch how some of these players in the NBA dress with the money they make. You could have been a bum and put that on. But no, I'm very conscious of how I look, you know, how clothes look, you know, different things that other people have on. I'm always conscious of that. And I always have been conscious of that because that's something that I've always been interested in. And nowadays, you know, they're coming out with these little short, what they call the taper look, and these little short jackets and kind of look like the Temptations of the 50s and the 60s. And I'm like, I'll never go there again, that's for sure.
I kind of feel like I should have dressed better before I came over here.
No, it's good. I have a sweater, suede shoes, but you know, I've always loved sweaters. So that's something, I have a closet full of sweaters. People always tell me you have beautiful sweaters and they call me a young Bill Cosby. And that's been a tag that's been on me for some years. But you know, I was fortunate. I grew up around individuals that like to dress well, that even though I grew up in the neighborhood, I lived in the neighborhood, but my mom wasn't that bad off. My mom took good care of us. I it wasn't like I was able to afford all of the things that I really wanted. So as soon as I was able to start working and put money together, that's how I became interested in the clothing, because I was able to afford what I wanted to wear and I could go to the stores and get the nice sweaters, and it was just something that I was surrounded by, and that's how I became interested in doing it.
Well, and I wonder if there's something to the idea that you don't necessarily have to be wealthy to be conscious of how you present yourself.
No, not at all. It's just about being neat. I've always been a very neat person. I still have people right today, they see me with my jeans on and they see a crease in my jeans. I'm like, yeah, I iron my jeans before I put them on any of my pants. I like, matter of fact, I put my jeans in the cleaner. So that's how I grew up. That's what I was surrounded by. And that's how I became Mr. Neat and liking to dress real nice. And now that I've been able to do it, wardrobe is pretty nice.
Well, and it must be something to think of the role that you played in designing these uniforms. When you look at how sports uniforms are designed today, it's a committee of marketers to some extent, that it's really about the merchandise that goes along with the sports uniforms. Whereas in the days that you did this, one person could sit down and put together a sketch and have a real influence.
I guess that's where I become an innovator of what I've been able to do. And, you know, because now you have the big shoe companies, and then, too, you have the fancy materials. And the material that we actually used was a nice material, but I think it was more of the color with the turquoise and the loud yellow that, you know, opened up everybody's eyes. But, you know, it was that type of thing that I think that set the trend for what's going on in college basketball, but not just college, but the NBA and all sports. And you look at the Olympics, what's going on, the type of thing. So I guess when it comes to that, I open the door not only to college, but to the world. And that's a very humbling thing. And it's nice to know that Bo Ellis will always be associated with those type of things in life.
Do you think teams just didn't pay that much attention to what the uniforms might look like before you came along?
Well, I really can't say that because Marquette was already doing some creative things with the bumblebee and, you know, the one uniform with the dot in the middle. So I can't take full credit for that. That was something that Coach McGuire had implemented before I came on, and I guess I was able to take it to another level.
It is something to watch the Olympics today and see the really unusual designs that some of the uniforms and certainly some of the clothes that they wore into the opening ceremonies look like.
Well, and you know, and then too, each country being representative of their colors, their styles, you know, the African countries, the Arab nations, you know, just all of the different things. So I guess to kind of open up some doors, I won't take full credit for that, but maybe it did. I know as far as college, I know for a fact that it started some new trends, and because Notre Dame would get new uniforms after NCAA tournament time, and I know that DePaul actually wore the uniforms outside the pants for years, and I don't know if I can really name another college that actually wore the uniforms other than Marquette and DePaul. And, you know, DePaul having a lot to do with me being from Chicago and being inner city and a lot of inner city kids, and they took the style and ran with it. But I really couldn't tell you what other colleges other than Marquette and DePaul wore the shirts outside the pants.
Well, and it's interesting. I think back, it was just a few years ago that in baseball, the Milwaukee Brewers were known as the team when they won a game. The first thing they would do is untuck their jerseys and then go high-five each other.
Well, that's what, for me, it was a natural reaction as a player to take my jersey out. There was no rules. The NCAA didn't care. Coach didn't bother me. It was just comfortable for me. And, you know, like I said, it just set a trend for the future. And it's very humbling to still be a part of it and still be mentioned in that sentence when it comes to uniforms and, you know, designs and things. So it's a wonderful thing.
Well, Bo Ellis, it's a fantastic story, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Bo Ellis played for the Marquette Warriors men's basketball team from 1973 to 77, a period that included two Final Four appearances and one national championship. He was also a designer of Marquette's revolutionary basketball uniforms worn during the 1977 championship season. We spoke with him on the campus of Marquette University before a screening of Untucked, documentary about those uniforms. So when was the last time you thought about an anvil and you weren't watching a Roadrunner cartoon? You'll think a lot about them after our next segment on Lake Effect from WUWN. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Blacksmithing brings to mind a lot of images, most of them out of history or myth, from the 19th century American West to Vulcan, the Roman god of fire. Most of us, if we think of a modern-day blacksmith, we might imagine someone who shoes horses. But while farriers are blacksmiths, not all blacksmiths are farriers. Kent Knapp is most definitely not a farrier, but he is a 21st century blacksmith who plies his trade right here in Milwaukee. Lake Effect's Bonnie North stopped by his shop in the Third Ward.
Our motto here at Milwaukee Blacksmith is get it hot and hit it hard.
The hot metal gives in to the force of Kent Knapp's hammer. He's making an ironwork scroll. He starts with a piece of 5/8-inch square steel about 3 feet long that he tucks into the glowing forge. Being the fanciful sort, I half expected to find Knapp working in a dark cave lit only by the glow of the fires and the sparks from the strike of the hammer on hot steel. But Knapp's blacksmith shop at the eastern end of the Third Ward is open and bright, the only shadows cast by the late winter sun that's coming through the large windows.
So I have two different forges burning here. One is a coal forge, which burns at about 3,000 degrees. Gets a small section of the bar really, really hot. But you got to be careful because it will melt in there. It's just a coal fire with air blowing underneath it, just like when you blow on a campfire. The other one is a gas forge, which is just natural gas with air blowing over it. That gets to be about 1,800 degrees.
Knapp has been smitten by smithing since he first walked into the Cedar Creek Forge in Cedarburg at the age of 19. He began studying with a Milwaukee master smith, but then he left Wisconsin with his family for a stint in New Orleans, a place that has its fair share of decorative ironwork, too. After 10 years away, the call home grew too loud to ignore, and Knapp returned, and more or less picked up where he left off. He's now in his 40s and making a go of Milwaukee blacksmith. And business is pretty good.
I do a lot of architectural pieces. Gates, railings, balconies, fencing, sconces. I always say everything from a coat hook to a driveway gate. We can do just about anything with steel here. You know, if you want a piece that looks like it was made 120 years ago, we can do that. If you want to match some existing ironwork on your 100-year-old mansion, we can do that.
But even though there's great art and craft in the pieces that Knapp produces, he says it's tough being a blacksmith today.
There's a lot of fabricators out there, guys who will cut and weld stuff together.
Knapp points to the scroll that he's making now.
You can actually buy that stuff from China or India that was made by a blacksmith who makes 50 cents an hour. And you can buy, a C scroll or an S scroll out of a catalog for a couple of dollars and then weld it into your railing or your gate or whatever. I don't believe in that. I believe that anything that comes out of my shop should be made by me. So I will not use pre-made pieces that come from overseas. Everything that you see in my work is made by me.
Back at the anvil, the scroll is taking shape. Knapp changes to a smaller hammer, the better to do the finer finishing work. This piece is exactly the kind of thing that you'd learn how to make at one of Milwaukee blacksmith's public classes, although it would probably take you or me a lot longer to make, and to make well, than it does Knapp.
Just hammering it over the edge of the anvil, getting a nice curve. And these are just some basic techniques. A scroll is probably one of the most common elements in ironwork. You'll see it all over the place. Unfortunately, in recent years, you'll see more machine-made scrolls than handmade.
For all of his skill, Kent Knapp isn't just a good blacksmith. He's also a walking fount of ironworking history, especially about the part that Milwaukee played.
I love this craft. I'm crazy head over heels with it. I just think it's the coolest thing. I spend my hours studying it. And you combine that with my love for Milwaukee and the fact that we had this guy, Cyril Kulnick, here, which, in my opinion, was the best American blacksmith ever. There's a couple other guys that come close, but I just feel that he was the bee's knees, if you will. And we had him right here in Milwaukee for almost his whole life.
Austrian-born Kulnick moved to Milwaukee at the age of 20, and he set up shop here in the early 1890s. His award-winning decorative ironwork graced the homes of many of the city's prominent figures, including those of Frederick Pabst, Paula and Irwin Eline, and A.O. Smith, whose home is now the Villa Terrace Museum on Milwaukee's east side. One of Kulnick's masterpieces, a decorative grill, is still on display at the Villa Terrace. Knapp lights up as he talks about Kulnick's artistry, and I wonder if he hopes that someday his work will be revered in the way that he reveres Kulnick's.
I'm not sure. I do what I can. I'm constantly learning. I believe that each year I get better, so who knows where I might end up in my lifetime. But if I can ever be as good as Kulnick, I hope so. I feel he's so important Like I said, not only to the history of American blacksmithing, but to Milwaukee.
But even if Kent Knapp's name isn't remembered for generations to come, his ironworking legacy will live on. Knapp's kids are already learning the business, and he believes they'll be better than he is. Meanwhile, the scroll Knapp has been working on is almost done. He sticks it into the forge to get it hot again, and then takes it to the anvil one last time.
Kind of true it up a little bit, make it straight. But anyways, you get the idea. That's the finished product. So in about 7-8 minutes, we went from regular square bar stock that comes out of a steel rolling mill. We tapered it out, did a little fishtail on there, and scrolled it over. Needed one more hit. One more hammer.
Does it always need one more hit?
It always does.
For Lake Effect, I'm Bonnie North.
Kent Knapp is the founder and owner of Milwaukee Blacksmith in the Third Ward. You can see a full slideshow of Knapp at work, including the scroll he was making in Bonnie North's feature, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That is the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, does the future of the Milwaukee airport include low-cost international airlines? We'll learn why some think that might be the case. Plus, what scientists are learning about the mental state called flow from studying extreme adventure athletes like big wave surfers and base jumpers. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.